Welcome to the UK's only weekly FM and DAB radio show about transport. I'm Mark Ovenden. In today's episode, we're chatting with one of the world's most read and respected travel writers. He's a former station manager of several London termini. He's worked for the Department of Transport, but he's better known as the man in seat 61. Welcome to the Catchcast, Mark Smith.
Hello, Mark.
We're going to get to your superb website in a bit, Mark. But do you mind me asking a question I quite often ask my guests? How and when did you first become interested in trains and transport?
Well, I think we need to go back to the 1980s, when I'm in my late teens and early 20s. It started with some school trips. For example, the school Russian trip, where we took an ancient turbine steamer of the Black Sea, of the Baltic Shipping Company, up to Oslo, Stockholm, then Leningrad, then caught a train to Moscow, and after a few days there, caught a train back through Berlin to London. I thought, this is great. This is a wonderful way of travelling. You're not strapped to a seat. The journey is part of the trip. It's not just all about the destination. This is what I want to do more of. And of course, once I got a bit older, I started buying Interrail passes and exploring Europe. And that's really where the bug came from.
Wow, lucky you. That sounds like an amazing trip.
It certainly was, in the days of the Soviet Union.
I would have loved to have done something like that. We went on a school trip to Paris, and I went sniffing around the Paris metro and nearly got told off by the teachers because I was more interested in looking at a metro than the Eiffel Tower.
It is difficult if you're in a group and you sort of wander off to look at something, I must admit.
Now, your website says that you ran away from Oxford to join the circus. Can you talk us through your first British Rail jobs? I believe they were in rural Kent, is that right?
After uni, I joined British Rail. It was one of the 1987 intake of general management trainees. And they put us through 18 months of training where we got to see everything, intercity, freight. We had a three-week signalling course in rules and regulations, which we thought would be the worst part of the course. It was actually the most fun. We were taught by signalling inspectors who loved their trade and gave us the enthusiasm for that. And eventually, of course, we were really keen to cut our teeth in the real rail world. So my first job was as the station manager for a number of lovely stations around Ashford and Kent. Marden, Staplehurst, Rye, Wye, that sort of place. It was a fantastic job.
Oh, it's a good introduction to the workings of the rail system, especially when you've got the lovely customers sometimes maybe having a go at you about late trains.
Oh, absolutely. I got to understand how customers think, which is really useful. If you're writing a website about travel, it's really good to get into the mindset of the people who are using the site and using the trains.
Exactly. I wish more British Railways executives could do that kind of thing. You must have been working on the system then down in Kent when it migrated to something they called sectorisation. And a lot of people look back with quite a lot of fondness on Network South East. What did the staff at the time think about the changes to Network South East?
Well, I came in 87. So Network South East, I think, was there from the mid-80s.
Right.
But yes, it made total sense. It was one railway for London, one point of contact with Transport for London, which of course you needed to operate with very closely. And then we had Intercity, which of course was one national network for intercity travel. It made a lot of sense. I think we're going to have to rediscover that in the current circumstances where we're renationalising our rail network. It's going to have to go full circle.
Let's hope so. So was it from there then that you went on to actually managing some of the big London termini, Mark?
I got promoted to station manager at Charing Cross.
I was the
last proper station manager at Charing Cross, if you like, based at Charing Cross, responsible for Charing Cross and Waterloo East, lord of all I surveyed. It was like being sort of captain of a small ship. Never a dull moment. It was the tail end of the IRA bomb threat, so that we were occasionally closing the station when we got a threat. There was occasional overcrowding in the evenings, because if anything sat down on you, if we lost a platform, it's only six platforms at Charing Cross. If you lose one, or if a train sits down where they pass over one track south and one track north between Waterloo East and London Bridge, you've got a problem.
It's chaos, yeah.
And you get overcrowded, so we had to control that. So yes, it was never a dull moment. Later on, they combined Station Manager Charing Cross and Station Manager London Bridge into something called Station Manager London Terminals, based at Cannon Street, and I got that job. And of course, when privatisation happened, rail track major stations took over the premises at Charing Cross and London Bridge. I found myself a tenant on what had been my own station, with rail track major stations as the landlord. I lost the central side of London Bridge to the South Central Train Operating Company and gained the eastern half of Victoria for a while. So, yes, never a dull moment indeed.
That was quite a mad time, wasn't it? The introduction of privatisation. Apart from the things you've mentioned there, how did some of your colleagues see these changes that were happening in the railways?
Well, to some extent, it was quite exciting. To another extent, it was yet another reorganisation and upheaval. And reorganisation always means you take your eye off the day-to-day running of the trains, which is not terribly good. We all had to work out new relationships. I had to work out the relationship with Railtrack major stations. For example, it was their job to announce our trains, but we did the job under contract to Network Rail, or rather Railtrack at the time. So basically, we paid them to pay us to announce our trains on their behalf. It makes sense.
And you, after that, became, I believe, a customer relations manager for a couple of train operators, didn't you?
Yeah, I was customer relations manager for the two Connex train companies, mm-hmm. which is why I say I do all my own stunts, two large commuter train operators, and setting up a new organisation, a new combined organisation, to handle all the customer comments and complaints about those, with a new phone number and new systems. That was quite a job as well. And then left that job, got made myself redundant, and found a new job with the Office of the Rail Regulator, mm-hmm. which got transmogrified, as these things do, into the new Strategic Rail Authority, which got reorganised again into the Department for Transport. And that's where it got really interesting, because I was head of the fares and ticketing team and found myself drafting the answers to parliamentary questions about fares and ticketing. And of course, we could go into the officials box in either of the two Houses of Parliament to hear the question being asked and our answer given. So that was absolutely fascinating. Even found myself sitting next to the minister in front of Gwyneth Dunwoody at a Transport Select Committee hearing, having questions fired at us.
Wow.
With strict instructions not to say anything unless I was asked by the minister, which was quite difficult because I like discussing fares and ticketing.
And tickets are enormously complicated in Britain, aren't they? You've travelled so widely around the world. I just wonder, do we have the most complicated ticketing system in the world, or are there somewhere else that's even more complicated?
We might well do. I mean, it grew up over time, and then with 20 different train operating companies all developing their own fares policy, there is still a lot of consistency in it. All the train operators use the same terminology, advance, off-peak and anytime, which is at least something. But the ins and outs of it really are more complex than they need to be. And quite simply, we need to start from a clean sheet of paper. Once we get Great British Railways in position, one of the first things they need to do is completely address... Actually, it's two things. It's not just one thing. It's the fare structure and it's the pricing. The pricing needs to be sensible and consistent, and a fare structure needs to be sensible and consistent.
We're speaking with one of the world's most prominent travel writers. He's known online as the man in seat 61. We're going to find out about your brilliant travel observation soon, but give us a small hint about how the Orient Express influenced your choice of pen name, please, Mark.
Well, there was this arms dealer called Zaharov who would always book compartment 7. In one of the sleeping cars of the Orient Express. And in the same sort of way, when I was going somewhere exciting, like Tokyo from London Waterloo via Brussels, Moscow and Vladivostok, or down to the Crimea via Berlin and Odessa, or down to Marrakesh via Paris and Madrid, I would always treat myself to Eurostar's first class. Nobody likes sitting next to a pillar, do they? So I would choose my seat carefully, because Eurostar were one of the pioneers of letting you choose your seat from a seat map. And the seat that ticked every box was seat 61 or 65 in coach 7, 8, 11 or 12 in the original Eurostar. So that's what I always booked. So when the website came along, the name was there, the man in seat 61.
Tell us about when and how you came to book your first few Eurostar tickets with that number.
Oh, gosh, this is so lost in the dim and distant past, I've forgotten. I know that I've booked it a lot, and I know that I always booked it when I was going somewhere special, but, gosh, that's a long time ago. Well, we're talking, Eurostar's been around since 1994, and I travelled on it even before it started public service. I was one of the guinea pigs, one of the rail staff who were invited to ride the test runs. I went on a trip to Brussels, out in first class and back in second class, which was the right way round, because they they couldn't get the coffee thing to work in first class on the way back, so we got away with that. And that was surreal. That was really surreal. We were travelling on a very obviously French TGV-style train with stewards and stewardesses with French accents, drinking champagne, passing through stations like Beckenham Junction and Penge East. And it was like your brain was saying, does not compute, you know, this shouldn't be happening. But of course it was. This was the beginning of the Eurostar revolution, which has changed the way we travel from London to Paris. Mm-hmm. And it's also changed the way a lot of people travel further afield to places like Spain or Italy or Budapest as well.
Mm, absolutely. I was lucky enough to go on it fairly early on, not as early as you, but I must admit my first couple of journeys and I was just holding my tongue in my throat with just absolute joy that you could get a train all the way from the UK straight through to the French capital. Stunning, stunning, stunning achievement. How many times do you think you've been lucky enough to sit in an actual seat 61? You can have a rough estimate.
Oh my gosh, I don't think I could start to calculate that. I mean, let's take this year. This year I've done, yeah, just come back from Egypt, but there were no seat 61s there. I've travelled in it at least twice this year already. I've got it booked again for another couple of occasions in September when I'm heading off to Italy on the inaugural run of the Brussels to Milan's European sleeper. I'm not sitting in it going to Paris in July with my family because, of course, it's a table for two. So when I'm with my family, it's nice to sit round a table for four, isn't it?
Absolutely. Unless you don't like your kids and you want to put them in a different carriage.
No, we're cool. We're okay. Last year, we went to Istanbul and Kuşadası in Turkey for a bit R&R by train both ways as a family. And we sat round a table for four leaving London and Eurostar. I hope our laughter didn't disturb the other passengers. But that's one of the great things about travelling on a train. You know, when you drive your kids somewhere, you literally turn your backs on your kids. When you travel by train, you sit around a table for four, you talk to each other, you have fun. It's family time. It's not lost time. Mm. It was absolutely great.
It was the early noughties, I think, when I guess you were still a full-time rail employee that you started your first blog. Can you tell us about how it all began, please, Mark?
Well, I was commuting to and from London, and the momentous day arrived where I finally finished my novel. Not novel I was writing, the novel I was reading on the train home. So I did what any commuter would do, wander into WH Smith's at Marylebone Station in London, try and find something else to read. I found it wasn't really a book, it was just a magazine, really. £2.95. In retrospect, probably the best £2.95 I have ever spent in my life. And it was a teacher self book about HTML, the language that websites are written in. And I read it and I tried it and it worked and I got a web page online. So I thought, what am I going to do with this? And I thought, well, to me, it's obvious. I'm going to do something about the massive gap between how easy and practical I've always found it to go from the UK to Spain or Italy or Prague or Poland or whatever by train, and how downright impossible it had become to find anyone in the commercial world, meaning the wider travel industry or the rail industry itself, who would tell you how to do it. Mm. I thought I'd put that information online. And I didn't really think anyone would ever see it. It expanded. It started as one page, how to get to these principal cities in Europe. It grew like Topsy and people started using it.
Wow.
And the first thing where I thought this might have traction was where I answered a question from a woman online on our forum. She turned out to be the travel editor of The Guardian, and she said, well, you're going to be website of the week in The Guardian. And I thought, well, is this a wind-up? I literally picked up The Guardian in a supermarket somewhere near the fruit and veg. I'd almost burst out laughing because there was my little home computer website as website of the week in the travel section.
Wow, that's amazing. And I did read somewhere that one of your motivations for starting Seat 61 in the first place was also as a bit of an antidote to those low-cost airlines, showing that international travel is actually possible without flying. Good man. But how would you sum up now the raison d'etre of what you do? Is it the same thing, really?
It is the same. It hasn't changed. There isn't enough information about how to travel by train, what surface transport, overland, over this sort of distances, simply because no one train company owns the journey from the UK to Italy or the UK to Istanbul.
Mm.
It's fragmented. Whereas, of course, the airlines, there's not a problem. There's an airline that flies from London to Italy. There are airlines that fly to Istanbul. So there isn't the same problem. So, yeah, the reason for it being there is the same. What people tell tell me has changed. Because when I started C61, if somebody said why they wanted to go by train instead of plane down to Italy or Budapest or Krakow or whatever it is, they would say they had a phobia of flying, or they would say they were medically restricted from flying, or they would say they particularly liked trains. And now they say two things in the same email. They'll say they want to travel more sustainably and they're fed up with the airline experience and want something different, more interesting, nicer, more rewarding.
Mm,
so
good.
That has changed. And it seems to be continuing, that the desire to travel more sustainably has become a big thing, picked up by the media and to some extent picked up by politicians as well.
Well, we just need to do it. We need to be using green alternatives if we possibly can. Now, I've thought here that you mentioned how humble your beginnings were, but there's now information on the site for, I think I counted, 5 continents. How many countries and destinations have you personally been to, Mark?
I've been to a lot of them, but I made an early decision this would not be about me. This would not be a personal travelogue. I would put information online that would help people travel. So there are countries that I haven't been to. I mean, I haven't been to Tibet, for example. Almost did. They changed the permit regulations at a crucial moment, so it didn't happen. And yes, I haven't been to Tanzania, for example. But I know what to look for. I can do the desk research. Other people help me with feedback and photos. So I can still do something useful for the countries that I haven't been. But I have been to a lot of them. I've been to most European countries. Not Moldova, but yeah, I've been to Albania and what have you. And it certainly helps if you've been there. There's no comparison between what you can do with desk research and what you can do if you've actually been there. And as it were, case the joint.
Well, because I was going to say, when you read the site, it feels like your attention to detail is absolutely incredibly thorough and so helpful. And very soon after you started Seat61, as you mentioned, this Guardian thing, you started to get quite a lot of recognition and awards. You've got quite a few accolades now, haven't you?
I have. I've been very fortunate in that respect. Yeah, for example, I've been the favourite travel website of Telegraph readers. I've been best travel website at the Guardian Observer Travel Awards. And it's really nice to be recognised because it gives you a pat on the back for the work that you put in. And it just makes you work that much harder. It makes you think, well, I'm doing some good here. Let's really push it and see if we can get it perfect. And I certainly haven't got it perfect yet, but I'm working on it.
I think you're doing very well. We're still with one of Britain's most acclaimed travel writers and host of the most practical guide to any surface-based trip, the very man in Seat 61, Mark Smith. Let's get into the nitty-gritty of how seat61.com works. Can you talk us through the user experience first, please, Mark? Let's say, for example, I wanted to avoid flying to, I don't know, somewhere like Barcelona. How does the site guide me through a trip like that?
Well, there's a list of countries, and you pick the country, in this case, Spain, and up comes the UK to Spain page. You select your destination, Seville, Cadiz, Alicante, in this case Barcelona, and it'll take you down that page to the London to Barcelona section, where it'll offer you various options, sleeper trains, daytime trains, and in each section it tells you the ideal train times outward, the ideal train times back, what the fares start at, and step by step how to buy your tickets, which of course can be a bit complicated. Sometimes you need to use more than one website, but it talks you through it.
You provide pictures as well, don't you, to show people what they'll see when they get out of a station, which I think is so helpful.
Absolutely. I mean, this is crucial because I could probably sell you an air ticket anywhere in the world and you wouldn't need to know what the plane looked like because they all look the same. But trains look different in every country. They've got strange sleeping accommodation like couchettes or sleeping car. What's the difference between those two? So people really need to see pictures to demystify and reassure. That's what I try and do. And the same comes with stations, because within that London to Barcelona section, you can click on London St Pancras, you can click on Paris Nord, click on Paris Gare de Lyon, click on Barcelona Sants. It'll show you what the stations are like, it'll tell you what their layout is, it'll tell you where you're likely to find your train, which set of platforms, tell you some good cafes or bars or hotels nearby as well, and hopefully give you the confidence, not just the information, but the confidence to make that journey by rail instead of flying.
It really changed my outlook as to whether or not we could do a trip like that, going from London via the Eurostar. But of course, not everybody lives close to the Eurostar, but you also give coverage of ferries as an alternative to trains. And you presumably tried those all out as well. well, do you?
Oh, yeah. Only last November I was on the Newcastle to Amsterdam ferry, which is a superb overnight ferry. I mean, mm-hmm. if you live up in Edinburgh, Glasgow, Newcastle, Carlisle, take that ferry overnight. You end up with a day in the lovely Dutch capital. Then there's a direct sleeper train to Vienna, change in Vienna for Budapest or Prague or Ljubljana. Wonderful option, bypassing that big smoke we call London.
Yeah, and not everyone lives within an easy stone's throw of London. So that is so, so helpful. And I think one of the other great advantages of your website over many others is it really does feel like a proper step-by-step guide, as we were just talking about. It feels like you've trodden every one of those steps yourself. You know how far each changeover is and what to look out for on the route. And you've literally done every journey yourself, I think, apart from one or two of the further ones. I suppose the bigger question is, how do you go about compiling all of these details, Mark?
Well, I've developed a format, mm-hmm. so that's easy. I know how I'm going to portray it. I make the journey myself if I can, and I know what people ask. I know the concerns they've got. After 20 years of doing this, I know that the Americans, for example, all insist on facing forward, so how you get a forward-facing seat is important to them. I know that luggage is an issue, so something about luggage and what to do. And I know that people want to understand how they make the, you know, those gaps between the train and the ferry. How do you get from Portsmouth Harbour to Portsmouth International Ferry Port?
Exactly.
Sometimes I walk it, sometimes I take a taxi. I can give you both options for that. Do a little Google map on how you walk it. That sort of thing, I think, makes the difference to how easy and how prepared. Gives people the confidence to make that journey.
Honestly, I think it's just so helpful, especially for those people that you mentioned earlier on who are a little bit sort of travel phobic in some ways. Now, you've also written a couple of books now based on your experiences. Do you want to tell us a bit about those also and why you decided not to do any more?
It was a while ago and I was trying to put the website in book form because some people do like sitting down with a book rather than looking at the internet. The problem, of course, is that the world of train timetables and ferries and so forth changes so often. The internet is the perfect medium for it. It was a lot of work to do the books. They became out of date very quickly, so it would have required a complete annual rewrite. So I've decided to stick with the website. It's a better medium for this sort of operation.
Because things change so last minute, don't they? I remember one little trip we tried to do to a Greek island, and we'd only looked it up the day before. And we arrived at the port. Is it called Piraeus, the port in Athens? We arrived at the port, and they just changed the timetables overnight. We had about a six-hour wait.
I can often get information on that sort of late changes or a problem, a major landslide or something. I can get it on the site in minutes.
Wow. And I noticed that you really do practice what you preach, Mark. I think one of your articles in the Times recently, who you also work for, was your trip over to the Orkneys by train and ferry.
Oh, yes. I mean, I must admit, I thought Orkney was just another bit of highlands and islands in Scotland. But of course, it's not. It's completely different. It's got a different history. It's got all that Viking involvement. There's a reason. There's a ruddy great Norseman on the side of the ferry. I loved it. Absolutely loved it. Always wanted to go and see Scarpa Flow because of all the history. But of course, January, bit of a risk. And I ended up coming with a cancelled ferry, catching a later one in the middle of a force 8 gale.
Oh, my goodness.
Had to brace myself a bit on the way back from the Danish pastries to my seat in the lounge. But other than that, it was a great trip.
And there's another form of transport that we don't have too much in the UK that you're a bit of a fan of, I think, aren't you? The gorgeous double-decker train.
Oh, double-deckers are great fun. I like a top, as long as I get a top-deck seat, of course. The French are into these. The French have got high-speed double-deck TGVs. Eurostar are buying double-deck TGVs, so we'll see in a few years' time, we will see double-decker trains coming in on HS1 into St Pancras. Top deck, you get good view, it's nice and cosy up there, as long as you can manage the stairs, and they're not that difficult, that's a great way to travel.
Oh, I love them, I love the double-deckers. They even have them on the RER in Paris, they're such good fun. You're also a bit of a great lover of interrailing, aren't you?
Well, interrail, it's almost how I started my travel, after those school trips. It was a rite of passage back in the 80s. Everyone did it. Everyone in the sixth form in university would buy an Interrail pass and would explore. Because in those days, there weren't any budget airlines. there were only full-service airlines that were expensive, and there's nothing like having unlimited travel in Europe. Europe is your oyster. And it's still there, but it's not just for young people anymore. You can buy it if you're an adult, child, even senior, and still travel around Europe flexibly in a way that you can't with these book-ahead airlines where cancelling or changing of plans costs a fortune. And of course, you explore it at ground level, and you can go to smaller places, not just the big places. It's an absolutely fantastic way of travelling, of ticketing your journey around Europe.
And you have to use seat61.com to get around. We could go on chattering for a few more hours, I'm sure, but we do need to pull into the final station, Mark. Thank you so much for joining us on the Catchcast journey.
You're welcome.
You will find Mark's astoundingly helpful website at seat61, that's SEAT61.com, where you can plan a journey and even buy tickets and passes and book hotels on it. He's also on all the main social media platforms with updates and news. Please join us next time for the show you can't miss. It's the Catchcast.